Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, February 26th, 2024. I'm senior producer Lou DeVizio. Let's get right into some headlines from around the state. New Mexico Congresswoman Melanie Stansbury wants answers from the Department of Homeland Security about conditions at the Torrance County Detention Facility. Backed by 50 other congressional colleagues, Stansbury sent a letter to DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas asking for transparency. The facility, managed by CoreCivic, houses men awaiting immigration hearings. According to Reuters, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement drafted a memo recommending closing or downsizing 9 immigration detention centers, including the one in Estancia. But Reuters reports the final version of the memo dropped the recommendation to close the Torrance County facility. That's as a 2022 recommendation from the Office of the Inspector General called for all detainees to be removed from the Torrance County facility until staffing shortages and unsanitary living conditions were fixed. Also, a Brazilian man's 2022 suicide at the facility led to an American Civil Liberties Union wrongful death lawsuit. Stansbury and 50 other representatives signed onto the letter and are asking DHS to provide a copy of the finalized 2022 ICE memo, a breakdown of what action was taken for each of the facilities, information on why the Torrance County Detention Facility was removed from the list, and what DHS is doing to address the 2022 report detailing the inhumane conditions at the facility. New Mexico businesswoman Teresa McCown is facing accusations of defrauding the U.S. government and two Native American tribes by underreporting taxes and royalties owed for oil and gas extracted from federal and tribal lands. Federal prosecutors recently indicted McCown on wire fraud charges and violations of the Federal Oil and Gas Royalty Management Act. She allegedly underreported production since 2017 through her companies, M&M Production and Operation Inc., and Shoreline Oil and Gas Company, which have operated in the San Juan Basin since the early 1990s. The indictment comes as Hillcorp San Juan LP was ordered to pay over $34 million to resolve similar allegations. Federal authorities uncovered over 400 incorrect reports filed between 2017 and 2021, resulting in civil penalties of over $1.7 million. If convicted, McCown faces up to 20 years in prison and $300,000 in fines. A U.S. appeals court overturned a ban on coal leasing from federal lands, potentially allowing more coal sales for public reserves and affecting climate efforts. The ruling, from a 3-judge panel on the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, cuts years of attempts to limit federal coal leasing. However, the demand for new leases is uncertain because of declining coal production on federal lands. The ban, first issued in 2016, was lifted by the Trump administration but reinstated in 2022. Republicans welcomed the decision, encouraging the administration to continue with leases, while the National Mining Association sees it as an opportunity for stalled projects to advance. Environmentalists are calling for action from the Biden administration to address coal's ongoing harms to climate and public health. The trial of Rust film set armorer Hannah Gutierrez-Reed is underway in Santa Fe. She's charged with involuntary manslaughter and evidence tampering in the deadly shooting of cinematographer Helena Hutchins in 2021. It's the first of two expected trials, with a second for actor and producer Alec Baldwin now scheduled to begin in July. Numerous questions remain in this case, chief among them being, who brought live ammunition onto the set? To discuss all of this and more, executive producer Jeff Proctor speaks with attorney Ahmad Assad and journalist Julia Goldberg.
Thank you, Lou. Joining us on screen today are Julia Goldberg, my former colleague at the Santa Fe Reporter, and attorney Ahmad Assad. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
As Lou mentioned, the trial for Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, the armorer for the film Rust, has begun. It's the first time a jury will weigh in on the deadly shooting of cinematographer Helena Hutchins. Julia, as briefly as you can, why did it take more than 2 years to get to this point, and what are the big questions at the center of this trial?
Well, I'll start with the second first. The big question is, how did live ammo get onto the Rust set? And who should be held accountable for live ammo in the gun that was fired that killed cinematographer Helena Hutchins? I think why it took so long has a lot to do with the judicial process as it's played out. The First Judicial District Attorney's Office has changed counsel in the course of the case. There's been a lot of motions. There's been a motion to dismiss. There's been plea deals. There's been just about everything that could happen in a case seems to have happened in this case, and it's taken this long to bring the first case to trial. And I'm very curious about the strategy of bringing Hannah Gutierrez to trial in advance of Alec Baldwin. I'm wondering if we sort of get a preview of that case and whether or not that hurts, that will hurt prosecutors. But I think probably Ahmad is the better person to answer that than me.
I'm curious about the strategy too, and we'll certainly get there in a moment. But let's break down the case a little bit against Gutierrez Reed. She's been charged with involuntary manslaughter and tampering with evidence. Ahmad, let's try to take them one at a time and as quickly as we can. Involuntary manslaughter is one of those crimes that makes a lot of people a bit nervous. What are the elements prosecutors must prove, and how does intent play into this one?
Well, there are two theories with regards to involuntary manslaughter. And normally people traditionally want to affiliate a homicide case or a charge or murder with some form of intent. This is not a specific intent crime, and certainly is not a strict liability. So we're not talking about the intent in the traditional notion that we understand. Generally speaking, you need negligence as a standard associated with one of the main count. The first count. And the alternative, it's more of a reckless standard. Essentially, general intent, if you will, and the elements basically have to, and the first charge have to do with negligent use of a deadly weapon. Some refer to it as like the misdemeanor manslaughter rule. And then the second one requires a reckless or willful disregard for the safety of others, this caution and circumspection component of the second alternative to involuntary manslaughter. So don't think of intent in the same way, but there is a general intent required, and those are shown by way of either negligence or reckless behavior.
Gotcha. So a little bit of a vaguer standard. Let's move to that evidence tampering charge. That one's a bit more straightforward, but in this case, there's a bit of a wrinkle on that one, right?
Right. I mean, at the end of the day, no testing has been done. The elements are required that these are essentially narcotics, factually speaking, with regards to the specific charge against Ms. Gutierrez Reed. They have to be narcotics, and she has to have done them in a way, she has to basically have given off this so-called bag of drugs in order to evade or evade or hide the evidence so that a future prosecution against her would not be forthcoming. And there's going to be some difficulty as we talk further with regards to the state's ability, I think, to prove that case, that
Gotcha.
charge.
Let's talk about workplace safety a little bit. That's an issue that's come up again and again in this case. An April 2022 OSHA report found that the Rust production violated numerous industry safety protocols, including documented gun safety complaints. Prosecutors tried to keep jurors from seeing this report, but the judge shot down that request. Ahmad, let's stay with you on this one. How will that report weigh on a jury when considering the charges?
As I understand it, the judge's ruling with regards to that report, and it will be favorable to the defendant, to Ms. Gutierrez Reed, as we move forward to it, will be played before the jury in the course of the expert testimony. Experts can rely on hearsay, they can rely on outside information and rendering opinions that they share with the jury to help the jury unravel and understand the circumstance. That OSHA finding of the scene and the set being a chaotic set from the get-go is going to play a very important role in this idea that Ms. Gutierrez Reed could not have performed her functions as a weapons specialist because she lacked the control of a very, very chaotic set, which is more in control of management rather than her own particular duties.
Julia, let's talk about workplace safety outside the context of a criminal trial for a second. This shooting has sparked a conversation, I think, about safety standards in film productions here in New Mexico, as well as Hollywood in general. Is that your sense? Has this been a conversation starter in that way?
Yes and no, Jeff. I mean, I think not as much as it might have seemed in the immediate aftermath. And I would attribute that to a few things. One, I think the writer and actor's strike kind of took the wind out of this being the central way in which people were thinking about the conditions for people who work in this industry. And then, as you know, or as I think, I assume you know, our our elected officials were not very loud about the Rust incident. There were two bills introduced in 2023 that would have required some kind of gun safety training for people on sets. They both died in the session. They didn't get much of a hearing. We haven't heard much from the state film office. We haven't heard much from the governor. We haven't heard much from the Santa Fe film office. California's governor did sign a fairly sweeping safety bill, but we haven't really, you know, no one's made it a priority in New Mexico that I've seen.
Okay, for just a moment here at the end of the segment, Ahmad, let's pivot to Baldwin just a bit. Of course, charges against him were dismissed last April, but special prosecutors Kerry Morrissey and Jason Lewis kept pushing. A grand jury indicted him also on a charge of involuntary manslaughter last month. How could the outcome of the Gutierrez-Reed trial impact the prosecution against Alec Baldwin?
I think in either context, the Alec Baldwin team and Alec Baldwin win. They have a vast advantage over seeing the roadmap essentially into their own case by viewing the case against Ms. Gutierrez-Reed. If she gets convicted, I think there is going to be this idea that responsibility was laid by a jury to the proper person and that it should end there. If she's acquitted, it just weakens the prosecution against Mr. Baldwin in a future trial. So in both instances, and the idea that it's being tried before his, are all benefits to the Baldwin team and Mr. Baldwin.
Really quickly, one last question on this. I'd like to kind of cleave apart the two cases a little bit. In the case of Baldwin, of course, he was the one holding the gun at the time that Ms. Hutchins was shot. Hannah Gutierrez-Reed was not. Yet they are charged with the same crime. How do we make heads or tails of that?
There is, by the way, there is a jury instruction with regards to causation that has been proposed by the defense team in terms of this case and Ms. Gutierrez-Reed. The issue against the case against Ms. Gutierrez-Reed has to do with her handling overall. The idea that she's responsible for handling that dangerous weapon, and in so doing, either acted or omitted to act in a way that kept everybody safe and ensured that that prop, once given to the chain of people, ultimately to Mr. Baldwin, should have been a prop that was safe to use. In terms of Mr. Baldwin, he's directly involved in the actual shooting. He's the one that handled the weapon itself upon the shooting that resulted in the death of Ms. Hutchins. So distinct features, but there is an element that is shared at some point.
But the defense, Baldwin's lawyers last week indicated that they are going to argue against him being held culpable as a producer in any way, right?
Okay. Right, right. And I think the producer aspect of it, I think it's been overplayed with regards to the charge here. There's a number of reasons why somebody would be a producer or co-producer and doesn't necessarily translate into the type of duty or negligence that is accused of specifically handling the weapon in the way that it was shot. And I think more specifically, I think the statement about pulling the trigger or not pulling the trigger is going to play the bigger role. And that only come into play with regards to Mr. Baldwin's interview and releasing that information, which I think was a big mistake.
Right. Interesting that producer bit in the civil context, maybe less so in the criminal. This case has been a mess from day one, and Alec Baldwin's legal team seems poised to exploit the many missteps from prosecutors. During a status hearing on Tuesday, Baldwin attorney Alex Spiro hinted that the defense team had some issues with the way prosecutors handled the grand jury proceedings that led to Baldwin's indictment. Ahmad, if prosecutors ignored or violated Judge Ellington's orders for that secret grand jury proceeding, as Mr. Spiro says, what does that mean for the criminal case against Baldwin?
And it depends factually, right? Because we don't know much about the basis for that motion. We don't know whether it's posturing by the defense or there's this strategy. But let's assume for argument's sake that there was particular direction by Judge Ellington and that the prosecutors did not follow those orders to the detriment or prejudice of the defendant in terms of the presentation of the case and whether possibly that defendant was either, affected by the shortcomings of the prosecutor. There could be a prosecutorial misconduct motion that is presented to the court for review of the orders and what, in fact, the state did. What that ultimately, if successful, would lead to a dismissal of the charges. It wouldn't, it would, in my experience, it would be very difficult to get it dismissed with prejudice. So it may be that this scenario is dismissed without prejudice, assuming the facts are what they are as prescribed by the defense. But that doesn't mean it ends totally, because they can still go back to a grand jury and reindict, unless there are specific findings that suggest otherwise, and this matter is dismissed with prejudice.
But this really does, what people need to look for here as this goes forward is whether it harmed the case against
That's
Baldwin,
correct.
Right? Whether there was That's some correct. Damage done to the innocence presumption, for example, right?
That's correct. I mean, it has to be more than just a not following the order. The effect of it has to be prejudicial to the target at that time, is not a defendant because it's a grand jury. So there has to be more laid out for us to fully assess kind of what parameters a relief would be, assuming that it proceeded forthwith. But we'll find out once they file that motion.
Soon enough. Okay, let's shift gears completely here. This case was custom made for the national media spotlight from the moment we learned about the shooting. That photo of a bearded Alec Baldwin on the phone has been literally everywhere for 2+ years. Yeah. Now, a local photographer snapped that frame, but now that we've arrived at trial time, national reporters are going to outnumber local journalists in that courtroom every day by 31-3, and that's per court rules. Julia, how might that influence the way people nationally and locally will perceive this case based on who's covering it?
Well, I mean, we've already seen in the course, you know, I think almost every national story I read refers to the district attorney here as sort of having bumbled the case. They talk about the problems that with the Santa Fe County Sheriff. There's already kind of a dismissal of it. I was looking as opening comments happened on court TV today, and people were analyzing the judge and saying she seemed nervous to be in national TV. I was like, you don't know that judge. I don't think she's nervous to be on national TV. So I think you'll get a little bit of just they don't know the players as well. So maybe they're more objective and also just not as knowledgeable.
Court TV, very, very well practiced in the dark arts. They know how to slow the walk down across the courtroom and do that whole thing. So let's shift gears again really quickly. Ahmad, I have watched you slug away in courtrooms full of cameras and reporters for many years. Does the strategy for defense attorneys or prosecutors change when the lights get brighter like this?
Yeah, because you're essentially speaking to two different courtrooms, if you will, that of the general public and then one, the jury that is before you. So you have to bring you have to be cognizant and bring your A game and understand that what you're doing, especially with Mr. Baldwin, like he's got a career after this trial, right? And so he's going to have to survive despite any type of outcome in the criminal case against him, for example. He's got to be able to survive out there. So there is a parallel proceeding that you got to be cognizant of when representing people that are high profile and high profile cases.
Let's unpack that just a little bit. In terms of the way you present the case to the jury, having had this conversation with you for a really long time,
sure.
I wouldn't imagine that it's supposed to influence that bit, but can it a little bit, knowing what's going on outside the courtroom?
You can bet that it does. And every person that is questioned at the beginning of jury selection, voir dire, you know they're coming in with some knowledge of this fact. This was highly publicized. And the questions posed by this idea of can you set all that aside and render a verdict based on the facts you heard today is, and quite frankly, it's a very difficult standard for any jury to meet. There's implicit biases, stuff that we don't even know we're built with as we come into a jury. So at the end of the day, it's going to be very hard for them to divorce. So you got to take that into consideration. When you're addressing the case, you got to take into account kind of what has been permeating in the media out there and package it to where it's effective for your client moving forward in the course of that trial.
Gotcha. So one of the things I want to get at here, Alec Baldwin is Alec Baldwin. He's an award-winning actor. He's a Saturday Night right. Live superstar, serious clout in the film industry. Julia, does his stature in Hollywood and this prosecution play into the idea that there are two systems of justice, one for folks like Baldwin and another for the rest of us?
I interviewed DA Mary Kermick-Always right before she brought the original charges, and that was the, a main thing we talked about was that her not wanting that to be the case, that she that the important thing was getting justice for this victim, regardless of who she had to be held accountable. And I found that credible when she and I talked, and I think it's a hard thing to do because I think the state is pretty out. I don't want to say outgunned because that's inappropriate, but outmanned in terms of the resources they can bring. Certainly, this case, I think our country's fascination with true crime and our country's fascination with celebrity kind of hits head on in this case. And Baldwin also carries a little bit of political energy around him from playing Trump, and people have very strong feelings about him. So I think that that media frenzy, we're sort of seeing all of those factors at once. I was surprised they got through voir dire in a day. I thought, how are they going to get a jury that can hear this? Are these people who, like, are they all Amish? Like, what, who are they? So we don't, we'll find out.
I
Can I
remember
jump in on
your,
that, Joe?
yeah, please, Ahmad. No, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I kind of agree and disagree a bit with Julia. I agree with regards to voir dire and how short it was to select a jury. I was very surprised about that as well. But I honestly believe that the status of Mr. Baldwin worked against him with regards to the prosecution in this case. I have to tell you that the idea that it was charged and then dismissed, and prior to that, there was the firearm enhancement that was added irresponsibly, and the sloppiness of the process, and the aggressive nature of continuing to come back and come back tells me that there was a struggle to keep the prosecution going. And I believe that his status as an actor worked against him in deciding to continue to be aggressive about pursuing the prosecution in this matter.
Let's.
To save face, they didn't want to drop the case. Is that what you mean?
Part of that is to save face because of the sloppiness. The other part is it may be their quest to receive some form of justice for the Hutchins family, but in doing so, there may be more aggressive efforts that would probably not have been normally attributed to an effort against somebody that may not be the actor, because the policy was everybody is the same under the law, and I remember the DA saying that it doesn't matter who you are
But
under
Ahmad,
the same
I
law.
mean, doesn't their continued bringing a case against the 24-year-old armorer kind of belie that? I mean, she's in there
Well,
too.
the problem is you can't bring it against Mr. Baldwin and not bring it against Ms. Gutierrez Reed. So if you decide to go after Baldwin, it wouldn't make any sense not charging the actual weapons specialist in the case.
Let's
And
riff on
then
this politically a little bit. I've got about 2 minutes to go with this segment here.
sure.
Of course, Marco Serna, who preceded Mary Carmack-Altwies in the district attorney's office, has announced he's going to take another swing at that race in the Democratic primary in June. In his
Right.
announcement that he's going to run, he popped her for the handling of this case. So, briefly, I want to let you both take a rip at this one. Is it possible that that message, the handling, not necessarily the outcome of the case, but the handling, resonates with voters? Julia, you first.
Yes, I mean, I think she was okay up until the revelation of those emails between her and Andrea Reed that were so, not professional and really made it clear they knew they were in the public eye, that had a sort of giddiness about it. I think without for not that, people might have been able to accept, yes, yeah, she needs more money, yes, she needs special prosecutors, but I think that really undermined her case a lot.
Ahmad, I know you've watched a lot of these races. Sorry to cut you off, Julia, but I got about 30 seconds. How do you think this plays politically, the handling of the cases?
I think it's going to be impactful. I agree with Julia. It's going to be impactful in the voters' decision this time around. Whether it's enough to defeat the incumbent is a different story. But it was handled poorly, and the handling in and of itself is something that was highly publicized. And it's hard to get rid of that memory and that information from the voters moving forward. And Cernas is going to ensure that that is not forgotten by the voting public.
Long way to go here in this thing. Julia
Yeah.
Goldberg and Ahmad Asad, thank you all for talking with me about this today. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure, Jeff. Thank you, Julia.
Thanks to Jeff and to Ahmad and Julia for making the time to speak with us. Moving on. House Bill 151, an affirmative consent bill sponsored by Representative Liz Thompson and four others, had a rocky yet familiar trip through the roundhouse this session. Last year, after several committee votes and amendments, a nearly identical bill died before reaching a final vote in the Senate. This year, Thompson's bill made it all the way through to the governor's desk. Representative Thompson and Alexandria Taylor, the executive director of the New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs, join me to discuss why they see the measure as a first step in changing the way people talk about sexual assault and consent. State Representative Liz Thompson, Alexandria Taylor, executive director of the New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs, thank you so much both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Now, this year, House Bill 151 that you sponsored, Representative, went through several votes and amendments before legislators ultimately did vote it through. Can you explain what the final product looks like?
Yeah, what the final product looks like. This year, we targeted only post-secondary education. And what this bill will do is make affirmative consent the standard for sexual activity. Only yes means yes, not saying no doesn't mean yes. And an important part of it is training for college, post-secondary students around what this is and how to report and all of those kind of things. And it also really weaves in trauma-informed care so that the victim isn't re-victimized by questions or statements or whatever. So that's it in a nutshell.
Okay. Now, Alexandria, I know you've been involved in this conversation for years. The bill initially included K through 12 components. I know you just said post-secondary is at college and university education is what this one applies to now. Can you describe what an affirmative consent policy would look like for elementary, middle, and high schoolers and how that differs from what is in this bill?
Yeah, when we started this in 2019 with Representative Thompson, as she said, it included the K through 12 portion. And what that looked like was that an affirmative consent standard be taught in the already existing One Health unit that they take either in eighth grade or in high school. At the time that we started this, my niece was a freshman in high school. She's now a sophomore at UNM. And the young people in our lives were asking for this type of education at school to make it very clear what consent is. And so affirmative consent standard makes it clear that consent must be voluntary, must be active, must be conscious by all parties involved. And so teaching that in a K through 12 setting is what is one of our priorities at the coalition, is to prevent sexual violence from occurring at all. And so it's beginning to equip young people with the tools necessary to make those conscious and affirmative decisions about their lives.
And even with, I mean, we're talking about training for eighth graders or high school, but even with preschoolers, you can teach them that no one can kiss them without asking if it's okay. No one, you know, if you want to hold someone's hand, you should ask. So teaching even young children that their bodies are their own and no one has any control over them except themselves, essentially.
Now, talking about kids as young as in preschool, kindergarten, first, second, third, do you believe that instituting these policies or starting these conversations at a younger age is important, and why?
It absolutely is, because it's about healthy relationships and boundaries, right? And it's about having agency over our own lives and teaching young children to have that agency over their lives. I think in recent years, we've seen messaging and campaigns around family holiday gatherings and to give young children the option of whether to hug family members or not. And what we're saying is that you have autonomy, you get to make decisions for your lives, and you won't be forced into situations that you feel uncomfortable with. It's really necessary. Young children have that spidey sense. They have that intuition. And then we somehow in our society force children to engage in activities that they don't want to engage in, as simple as giving someone a hug that they perhaps don't want to give a hug. I always ask, I'm blessed to be a godmama to some amazing little children, and I always ask them, may I have a hug? And if they say no, I'm like, cool, right? And that is them being able to set the boundaries for their lives and what they are comfortable with from a very early age.
Now, how would you address concerns from parents who might be wary of their child being introduced to these conversations? I know a lot of the conversation in a general sense moves towards sexual behavior. And I know that's what a lot of parents think of when they hear this conversation about affirmative consent. How would you allay those concerns about a situation that they feel might be out of their control as their child's being taught about this away from them?
Well, one of the simple ways that I always talk about this is that when we're out at dinner and I want one of your fries or my child wants one of my fries, I've taught him not to just reach over and grab a French fry off my plate, but to ask, may I have one of your fries? And I can either say yes or no. That's what we're talking about for early age. It's age appropriate. And then as children become more mature, then we start introducing this in a healthy relationship and sexual relationship context. And so we're talking about age appropriate content. Affirmative consent education is not something that someone is making up. It has an evidence base behind it. The CDC has proven that this is a primary prevention measure to end sexual violence in our society. And so we're talking about providing age-appropriate education from a very early age. And then as young people mature and get older, evolving that conversation to include healthy relationships and sexual relationships. In our current system, which this bill doesn't address the K-12 portion, but in our current system, parents have the option to opt their children out of the one health unit that's covering healthy sexuality.
Okay. Now, Representative Thompson, have you heard concerns, or did you hear concerns during debates about this in the Roundhouse that ultimately led to the bill being narrowed to just universities and colleges?
Because people don't understand. They think that if you're teaching affirmative consent, you're teaching a kindergartner that that they shouldn't have sex or they should have sex. And as Alexandria said, that's not it at all. It's teaching them that their bodies belong to them. And we have all heard the horror stories of teachers and priests and folks who molested kids, and the kids didn't know that they had the right to say no, and they didn't know that that they should tell someone. So the reason that we scaled it back is because it hadn't passed, and we wanted to get something on the books. We're not finished with this. We will be back. And my ultimate goal, I think the whole coalition's ultimate goal, is to have this the standard for all students. And as Alexandria said, in the eighth grade or high school, towards the more sexual side of it. But even with little kids, teaching them things like don't take someone else's food without asking, don't kiss someone without asking. And if someone asks you, you can say no.
Now, Alexandria, as we've discussed, you played a large role in advocating for this bill. Can you tell us exactly what is the concrete problem that you are hoping to fix with this legislation? And do you think that House Bill 151 solves it?
I think that this is a critical first step in us setting a standard and beginning to have conversations that will shift culture. So what we have seen on our college campuses for far too long is young people entering a new stage of their life and not having clarity around essentially the rules of the game. And so what we did was build a broad coalition with Representative Thompson's leadership that represented communities of colors in New Mexico, young people, queer and trans communities, to really talk about what was your experience as you were coming up? What is your current experience on college campuses? So right now, we know that in New Mexico, 1 in 4 women, 1 in 6 boys and men will be the victims of sexual violence. And that is also included on our college campuses. I hear, when I travel across the state, I hear from young people and their parents who may have experienced sexual violence that they don't know how to navigate the systems that exist on our college campuses. So the first part of this bill is education. It's about ensuring that everybody at our college campuses know that the standard for sexual activity is one of affirmative consent. They're receiving that education at orientation. Faculty, staff, contractors are also receiving that education. And then people have clarity about what happens should something happen to them. They need to know what to expect from our institutions of higher education as they navigate an investigative process. They need to know that they have access to community-based resources such as advocates, mental health counselors, sexual assault nurse examiner programs and communities of support to support them through this time. And so that's what this bill accomplishes and sets the foundation for.
And as I've carried this bill through the years, I've had so many people come to me and say, I wish I would have known this. I mean, I'm getting up there in years, and I wish I would have known this. It probably would have prevented some. I had a young man in my office, and he said, you know, when I was in high school, I wish I would have known this, because what the boys did was see which girl was the heaviest drinker, try and get her drunk and have sex with her. And so we need to make that totally not happen anymore. And so lots of folks, including elderly folks, have come up to me and said, I wish I would have known this.
Now, a similar version of this bill in the last few years have failed. It failed to even reach the Senate floor. Why do you think it was different this year?
I wish I knew. I wish I knew what the magic was. I think part of it was that we scaled it back, and it was in Senate Judiciary. It was very much, I don't want to say gutted, but a lot was taken out. And being in Santa Fe, being in the legislature, compromise is king. I mean, you can't always get what you want. And so we're taking this as a positive first step, and we're going to be back. There are elections coming up. All of us are up for re-election, so the Senate and or the House may look different next year. So we're just gonna keep on, because we want to protect our young people.
Now, you both have said that this is just a first step. What are those next steps? Whether through legislation or other public outreach?
There were some significant parts of the bill that were amended out. One that has been heavy on my heart since last week is that we had a requirement, a proposed requirement, that the institutions of higher ed enter into MOUs with service providers off campus to ensure that people are immediately connected to resources in their communities. We are going to be working with colleges and universities all across the state to still try to make that happen, even though it won't be mandated by law once the governor signs this, because we know from the Sexual Assault Coalition, as that service providers across the state, that early intervention is really crucial for those who have been victimized. And so we really want to see that happen. There's going to be a lot of work when you're talking about culture shift. And one of the reasons I think it's taken us 5 years is because we are talking about culture shift. I kept saying, I can't believe our little affirmative consent bill is causing all of this. And one of my colleagues reminds me, perhaps it's not so little. Perhaps it's that first domino that opens the conversation. We can't prevent the stories that Representative Thompson has been hearing. We can't prevent that by not talking about it. We have to make it clear what healthy sexual relationships look like, what affirmative consent is, so that people are not operating in the unknown. And so this is that first step, and there's going to be a lot of work that has to happen administratively with our colleges and universities to ensure that they're using the proper education, the policies are being created, and that students are being educated.
And these subjects have been taboo for so long, which makes it easier for the perpetrators, because nobody wants to talk about it. It's shameful. We don't want that to be. We want it not to happen. We don't want to not talk about it.
Representative Liz Thompson, Alexandria Taylor, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you to Rep. Thompson and Alexandria Taylor for speaking with me. In our final segment of the podcast this week, an introduction for one of Albuquerque's newly elected city councilors. After winning a runoff election last fall, Nicole Rogers began her tenure representing District 6, Albuquerque's Southeast Heights, in January. I'll ask Rogers about her priorities for the district and what it means for her to be the first Black woman to serve on Albuquerque's City Council. Albuquerque City Councilor Nicole Rogers, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we're nearly 2 months into your first year as a City Councilor for Albuquerque. How have those first couple of months gone, and what concerns have you heard from your constituents, both in your campaign and since you've taken office?
Sure, yes, thank you. 2 months, it feels like I've been here a lot longer, which is a good thing. And I think the biggest deadline for us was our capital request for the legislature with the session that just came in. So I promised to hit the ground running, and we really hit the ground running. Right after the runoff election, December 12th, after Christmas, I went right into the office to start getting a handle on where we were in our district, asking the departments to give me a list of everything that's happened as far as projects, in whether it's parks, roads, streets, housing, whatever projects are slated for our district. Give me a list of those. How much funding do we already have? How much funding do we need to be able to finish these projects? So I can make some really good, thoughtful requests to our legislature. And so met the deadline by January 11th, got sworn in January 2nd, and really just have hit the ground running, making sure I get back to the neighborhood associations to begin to kind of begin to set our direction for where we want to go in the next 4 years. Some of the things I heard, I think they really haven't changed from the campaign to now, which is homelessness and housing, public safety, still a big concern for especially my district. And poverty is really the other one that I've been focusing on, not just in the election, but now just trying to get a handle on what the city is doing for poverty, which is not too much. So we have a lot of work to do, especially because District 6, all of the poverty for Bernalillo County is really centered in District 6. So we have to think about that as well.
Now, those things that you just mentioned, what is there something specific among them that inspired you to run in the first place to that you wanted to get accomplished?
Yeah, for me, I really wanted to align the community voice with the city's priorities. You know, having worked in the city the last couple of years and being a community activist and really doing community work, I often saw those priorities not aligning. And I really didn't see representation for me. And so that's really what inspired me to just say, why not? Why not me? And so I jumped in the race late, last candidate to get in the race. We had 6 to start and 4 ended up on the ballot and then had to do a runoff. So, yeah.
Now, speaking of that representation, what does it mean to you to be the first Black woman serving on Albuquerque City Council?
You know, I feel the weight of the responsibility, I think, is the first thing that comes to mind. It's sad that it's taken this long. But I really, during the campaign, didn't push that up as much as I think most people wanted me to, because I really wanted people to choose me because I'm smart, I have experience, lived experience and professional experience that could really help us align more of the city's priorities with the community's priorities. So I jumped in and I'm excited that I did, and it was a lot, but I'm excited.
Yeah. I'm sure it is hard to balance those things. And have you heard from Black residents in your district, but across the whole city too, about what it's like for them to see themselves represented on the council?
Yeah, I think that was the most overwhelming moment, I think, during the swearing in, to see how many community members came to see me get sworn in. People commenting that they had the same feelings that they felt when they watched Obama get into office, which was like, whoa. Can't even fathom that for myself. But representation matters. It really, really does. And so to be in, you know, in the line of greats like, you know, Dr. Len Mallory and others that have been the first in our state, it's really an honor. But I really am weighed down by just wanting to do a good job. Yeah, that is
certainly
the biggest thing, yeah.
Now, earlier this month, you and Councilor Renee Grout sponsored a bill to create a working group to reimagine the city's motel voucher program. How exactly does that program work now, and what problems do you see that you were hoping to address with
this? Sure. I think right now we don't. We have motel vouchers that are for emergency situations for individuals or families who are experiencing some trauma. So DV, domestic violence kind of situations, unsheltered folks who just are having a gap. And so that's typically what most of our vouchers, hotel vouchers, are used for. But what I don't see is more collaboration amongst not only just city departments, but also the hoteliers that are accepting those vouchers, making sure that we're taking their needs into consideration when we're housing folks that are in trauma. It could potentially, you know, cause some issues for some of the hoteliers. So we really want to bring a team together, folks with lived experience who've used the voucher system, people who've administered vouchers, and hoteliers who can come together and really talk about how to make that a better process for folks so that we can maximize the dollars that we have for that, which is quite a bit. I mean, we have I want to say over 5 million for motel vouchers. So we want to make sure that we're using them in the right way to help people over the gap, but also taking into account, you know, the things that our hoteliers are having to deal with too. So,
now, homelessness, of course, is a significant issue that we've been dealing with that program ties into a bit, yes, too. Last month, you talked about a request that you made to the city attorney for a script for city employees when dealing with homeless encampments on city property. Have you received that script yet?
Yes, we did. It took about 2 weeks or so, 2.5 weeks after we, and it's actually, it was a script they mentioned that had already existed. So it was more like, well, just give me, what I was asking for was really a process, a written process of how we're responding. That's not just for staff, but also so community knows the expectations, especially when we're talking about where people can camp with our encampments. And so for me, it's about knowing that we have an actual defined process that all of our departments are following. And I think that line of questioning led us there. I don't think we had it before. And so I think the bottom line is we need I want to see a more humane, dignified response to how we deal with our unsheltered folks. The bottom line is we don't have a lot of folks for people to go if they do not want to be in a shelter. And that's what we need to work on is the whole continuum, meeting people where they are, getting them stable to be able to be housed, I think is what we're missing. And so, yes, I did get that information, reviewing over just what the process is, how many departments are involved in that process. It's hard to align with 5 different departments doing the same kind of work. So I'm excited that we're moving towards a more defined process.
Okay. So are you satisfied with the script itself? And is there a place that the public can see it?
Yeah, actually, I hadn't thought about getting it online. I will absolutely do that. I'm just kind of reading for myself and like trying to understand. You know, I think for the scripting for myself, I don't think it is, I don't personally think it's enough. Lauren Keefe, our city attorney, talked about things like getting people storage bins so that we can store their things so they don't lose their precious belongings like driver's licenses, birth certificates, things like that. I didn't see that in the script, so I don't feel confident that we're actually doing that. So I think we need to flesh out a couple of those details first. And then I would absolutely love to get that out to community because then we all know what to expect.
Okay. How does it fit with the injunction that the city's facing right now too, tied to the lawsuit after the clearing of Coronado Park?
Yeah, I know we were waiting on more clarification of what the judge meant from as far as you need a place for them to go before you clear them. And I felt pretty clear about what that meant. It means if you're moving someone from a place, you need to have another place for them to go. And so, with the injunction, that's still in place, and so we still need to respond, though, and so we just need to make sure that our response is humane and dignified and we have an actual place to go, to send people. And our capacity, I think that's the biggest thing I think public needs to know. The city's capacity is based on the contractors that we hire to do the work. And now the city is pretty much has one contractor for all of homelessness. And so we have to do, my work is going to be focused on technical assistance of other providers to make sure that they can bid for these jobs at the city and actually help us. Because right now that's a barrier. Whereas I'm talking to a lot of our providers in our district and they just don't have the technical assistance to be able to go after the big RFPs that the city puts out for homelessness. So we have to do better at getting folks who are already doing work, who don't get city funding, access to that by technical assistance so they can help us do this work.
Now, during last fall's race, you campaigned on introducing a pilot universal basic income program to address poverty in the city. What exactly would this program look like, and have you had any progress introducing it into council?
No, we haven't introduced it yet. The great thing is we already had the groundwork laid for this. Previously in my work with cannabis equity, actually, the legislation put forward that council did pass at the end of last year said we could use tax revenue from cannabis for a pilot for universal basic income. So that groundwork's already laid. Right now, I'm pulling together folks like we have at Albuquerque for guaranteed basic income that I'm going to be engaging. I'm researching what other pilots have already been done in our state so that we can put together a really good pilot for Albuquerque. What I'm looking at is doing to be smart and have some alignment with some of our other issues in the city, specifically hiring for like police, frontline, firefighters, bus drivers, is doing it for students who are enrolled at CNM in these programs. So saying, hey, like you're already doing something to further your life, your career, let's give you a little basic income to help you get over that hump in the hopes that you come work for us after you graduate. So that's kind of what I'm floating around with community to see how that would flesh out. But I think that would be a really great way for us to do two things at the same time, where we're helping folks over the hump, but also hopefully getting some more hires into our tough to fill jobs at the city. So yeah, I'm excited about that. We're going to be having some strategy sessions around poverty and around this universal basic income all in March. Okay. And so those dates are already on our website. You can go to those. You can RSVP to come and help give input about that, because I don't want to come up with all this myself. I really want to be focused on community helping me decide on these plans. Sure. Before we move forward.
Now, I want to ask a few questions about the federal investigation into APD's DWI unit.
Sure.
Now, according to City Desk ABQ, APD's internal investigation has expanded to include two internal affairs officers, one lieutenant, within the internal affairs department. Mm-hmm. So that's two members of that department. That makes seven officers under investigation overall. Now, when this story first broke a few weeks ago, you and others on the council expressed some frustration with how you found out about it. A bit of a lack of communication from the Keller administration. Since it's broken, has that communication gotten any better? Are you more satisfied as these new developments come out?
Yeah, I think all of us were shocked that we didn't at least get a courtesy call that something like this was even happening. I understand that there's an investigation happening and they can't kind of divulge all of those for the investigative purposes. But at least a heads up would have been nice, so that we're not fielding these calls like, hey, did you hear about APD? And I'm saying, what happened? And having to go look it on the news to find it out. So that's just never a good way to find something out like that. We don't like being blindsided, just like the administration doesn't like being blindsided. And so I think since that's happened, we've had a lot more communication with APD regarding what's happening, and that the fact that they're going to launch an internal investigation, which our questions were, well, when you found out about this however long ago, why didn't an internal investigation start then, not when it hit the news? So I think the bottom line is we need to figure out what happened. We need to figure out processes to make sure, policies, procedures, to make sure it never happens again. And so I'm committed to working with APD and FBI to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And that means we have to look at our processes. I also am calling on the state to also, let's think about this on a bigger scale, because it's not just DWI cases. I'm also concerned with domestic violence cases and failure to appear across the whole spectrum, not just DWIs. So I would like to call for the state to put together an actual statewide database where all of the entities actually can talk to each other and not have different systems that don't talk to each other. And I think that's going to help us in a lot of areas. And I'd like to see the state work with us to do something like that in the interim. While we have the next session next year, we can come up with a process and a plan to do that. So I am going to be calling the state to do that and working with county and city on some different programs I'm looking at, called like one that we're looking at called Unite Us, that would do that, would help us communicate across all of the systems. We did it in healthcare. I have a healthcare background with Affordable Care Act mandated that we had electronic medical records and that we all systems had to talk to each other so that patients had what they needed. And it's the same here. We need to be able to have that information to be able to do what we need to do to keep people safe.
Now, how has the situation, in your estimation, affected public trust in police, especially in District 6, where police have a historically strained relationship with the public?
Absolutely. I think this definitely set us back. I think, you know, in especially, you know, doing work with trying to strengthen those relationships with the Black community and police, I think definitely the trust has been lost. I think we were making some strides, but this definitely set us back. It's just no other way to say it. It's the truth. And so now we have to be more transparent than we're used to, and we have to be open and not be afraid to be transparent about what we need to do to make things better.
Now, we'll keep an eye on that story, of course. Beyond what we've discussed already, What are your main priorities for the rest of your term as you finish up your first term, or start your first term, really?
Yeah, I think for me, the priorities are aligning the city's budget with the community's priorities. My district desperately needs affordable housing. And I want to be very specific about what I mean by affordable housing, right? Because what's affordable for me, what's affordable for you could be different. So we need to be talking about housing on the entire income spectrum. In my district, we need low-income housing. And even some parts of my district, we need other housing price points. And so for me, I really want to see what we can do in our district to actually meet that gap, not just for low income or what we call affordable, but also for folks who can afford more. Because what it is doing, if you can afford $1 million house, it's hard to find one, right? And then you're going to here, and it's kind of pushing everybody back down the line. And so I think we need housing on all X spectrums. So I'm interested in working. We had some developers that purchased the two big tall buildings, the old bank building on San Mateo and Central, for housing. They want to do market rate and affordable. So I'm excited to see about that. We have food insecurities that we need to tackle right away. So I'm looking at what's happening with Walmart. Can we buy Walmart that closed? We're looking at the Walgreens across the street to see if we can purchase that, to try to get some fresh food there as soon as possible, either with our farmers through a farmer's market that they can be at all week, not just on the weekends, because our farmers are still saying they have a lot of waste. And so let's fix that and get some food there immediately. So food desert, housing, public safety is a really big one, and encampments in my district. We have to have a stability site, and we don't. I mean, Gateway's supposed to be that. But again, if we only have one contractor who's handling all of homelessness for the city of Albuquerque, that's why we can't do more at the Gateway, because that particular contractor can't handle anymore. And so we have to do, as I'm really focused on, who else in the community can help do this work, and how can I get some technical assistance to them to be able to respond to those requests that we have for help. Especially with homelessness. So I really want to say to our community too, that we need everyone to come to the table to come up with a solution that we don't all have to agree on, but let's talk about consensus, right? Like, I don't love it, but I can live with it, because we have some tough things facing our community and we have to work together. And a stability site is something we really need here, especially in District 6.
City Councilor Nicole Rogers, thank you so much for your time and for being here on New Mexico in Focus.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast this week. Be sure to follow along on all of our social media pages. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. If you follow us during the week, you can stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio for Monday, February 26th, 2024. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.